here we are. It is time for a brand new and live burning platform on the podcast party. You can go and subscribe and like and all of those things. Do it, because then I don't have to repeat myself at the end of the show again. All right. This morning, oh, it's just the left wing's worst nightmare come true. Oh, sweet Jesus. There are people howling like they will be when Trump wins in November. There are going to be blue-haired people who will have stumbled upon this podcast by mistake this morning, who will be running in terror for the hills. Because why? Well, because this morning, I'm afraid, we've got the most right-wing people on planet Earth here. That's what they'll call you anyway, whether you are or not. The two hosts of the Overton Pod, which I've been listening to lately. It's a great podcast, and I really suggest that you subscribe yourself to it, mostly because I got an hour and a half yesterday of unadulterated, solid commentary on American politics. And you can get that kind of thing from the two gentlemen seated opposite me this morning, none other than Jonathan Witt and Canthan Pillay, no strangers to the Burning Platform. Hello, you two.
How are you doing?
Good morning. Well,
it's good to see you in the studio.
Yeah, I mean, I can't believe I woke up to come and sit with you two. But, you know, sometimes you make a terrible mistake. What can I say? It's very nice to see you both. All right. At risk of perhaps repeating some of the stuff you've already put on the Overton podcast, there's a world of stuff to discuss, but let's start domestically, because I don't want us to bugger around with uninteresting subjects in what could be an hour, could be just over an hour of all sorts of discussions. So let's just do a quick summation. By the way, for those people wondering where Pumi is this morning, she is ill, and we are all sending her good wishes to recover as quickly as possible. And no, I don't know if it's COVID or not, so don't ask, because that was the excuse they used for Biden the other day. COVID. Can you believe it? 5 years later. Unbelievable.
Triple vaccinated, double boosted?
Multiple boostings. Multiple. Tough. Injections Shame. Right into the head. Yeah. Right into the brain stem. Straight up in there with all kinds just of vaccines.
Just mainlining Pfizer. Yeah,
just absolutely. Whatever the pharmaceutical companies tell him to do. Shame.
I just want to point out that I called it right in terms of Obama's interference.
You did. So what I thought was interesting as a takeout of your pod that you guys did the other day, that you basically explain to people how the Democratic Party is run by two camps. There's a Clinton camp, believe it or not, that's still a thing, which Crooked Hillary is running. And then there's Obama and Big Mike, who run the other side of it, when they're not killing their chef and drowning them off Martha's Vineyard.
Oh, that just disappeared from the news.
Yeah, it's funny. Everyone's forgotten about
that. But we're all very worried about Stormy Daniels, yeah. A woman of really good morals and all the other women who've been brought before Republicans recently with absolutely spurious claims of nonsense. But let's get into South Africa for a start. How's the GNU doing? What kind of updates are you guys getting from your various sources? And are you still, as I am, marginally to cautiously optimistic?
I think optimistic's a loaded word. I think...
I knew it would be complicated with you.
Is it true that we're better off than we were before the elections? I think the answer to that is yes, if only for the entertainment value. I mean, props to Gayton. He's doing all of the fun stuff.
Yeah.
If you look in terms of what our brilliant Minister of Prisons has been doing, and if you look at the raids on the prisons and the confiscation of massive amounts of cell phones and drugs. You know,
that's Wimpit.
Yes, Wimpit. It's been so certainly... You know, we can't expect good government, guys. Let's be clear about this.
It's too much to ask.
But we can expect entertaining government. And okay. I'm enjoying the entertainment right now. What do you think?
Yeah, so that's a part of it. The other part of it is that I think the DA is taking a really good, and Gayton, who's taking a similar approach, which is we realize that we're in bed with communists and we're not going to really change that because they control.
But hang on.
They control the show.
Yeah, I'm always in a huge hurry to like slam and lambaste communists. Mm. And I see we can talk about Maduro just now, who's actually worried Elon Musk is going to come to Venezuela and fight him.
Who threatened him with space lasers yesterday.
He's warned his security detail to be on high alert in case Elon Musk magically, like Iron Man, appears in a suit ready to fight him. I mean, the guy is completely deranged. But haven't a lot of the communists gone.
Yeah.
So I mean, we've got really low-level communists.
Well, no, we've got the highest-level communist in the government, which has been sold to you by the media as the best person in the ANC, Cyril. Which is Cyril. Yeah. More communist legislation has been passed under Cyril, major communist legislation, than in the history of the entire country. So, you know, NHI being one of them, the Bella Bill.
Which the courts have now struck down.
No, well, they haven't struck it down. They've struck down a very, very small part, which will be meaningless ultimately. So, you know, there's that. But what I was going to say is that they've all taken this role as, look, we're just going to be good in our area. So this is going to be an advertising campaign.
Okay.
Basically. And the DA ministers are going to say, look, we're going to show what
look
we're
how
doing.
Competent we
exactly.
are.
Exactly. And so when we come to the next elections, they're going to say, well, the choice is between look at our competent
and
ministers.
Shane, what the DA never seems to realize, and listen, I'm not particularly angry or opposed to them in any which way in this government of national unity. They may end up doing a lot of good, but what they always seem to get right is that they think that showing that they're competent is going to win them ANC voters. And ANC voters don't give a shit about competence.
Yeah,
so and they never will.
So I think I half agree with that. I think there's evidence to show that middle class ANC voters do, and so that is the 6% that defaulted to either not voting ANC or voting for other parties as a result of NHR, which was passed 2 weeks before. Polling clearly shows that they lost 5 to 6% just from that decision, and that 5 to 6% is obviously not the lower classes who are voting for them to get free stuff. That is the middle class who have achieved through their own.
They're the same ones who don't want NHI and all of those.
Yeah, because they've got medical aid, which they pay for themselves.
Yeah, which
and they know is worth it.
We're talking middle class black people. Let's be very specific about this.
Because this is South Africa. We have to talk like that. But Canton, I still have to take you on about something while we're talking about party politics in South Africa, which I hope will be the minimum of our conversation here today, because I don't think it's that interesting or we've got anything more to unpack. But you were very gung-ho, and frankly, I was too, about Colleen Makubele. What a disaster she turned out to be.
That was gung-ho. Remember?
You did vote for her.
I'm going to repeat what I said. I said, she doesn't have a hope in hell, but I'm going to vote for her.
And you did.
And I did. That's exactly what I did.
Well,
yeah.
Walk past that stain on the wall for the rest of your life.
No, it's not a stain on the wall. You know, I still voted DA in the province. That didn't really turn out well.
But you should have voted for Panyaza. Look how he's bringing everyone together.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's amazing stuff happening there. Panyaza, and now his favorite thing is causing shit in schools. And that's the latest.
But that's always been his thing.
No, he loves that. If he's not spending $400 million cleaning them.
Okay, South Africans do love a made-up race war because racism is now so rare and so vanishingly difficult to find that we have to now go to high schools and infiltrate WhatsApp groups and then look for the most indirect, most subtle forms of terrible racial discrimination. And then we have to punish teenagers for this kind of thing. I mean, it is just Orwellian on another level. I haven't
just ahead of the matric exams as
just ahead of the matric exams. I mean, the fact that there are schoolgirls, and let me tell you, I wouldn't want to be a schoolgirl. I wouldn't want to be a girl.
I just want to say I wouldn't want to be a girl. Okay.
Yeah. In the age of social media, especially, I think it is exceedingly hard to be a young lady in this world trying to grow up with all the pressures of what it is to be among like other bitchy girls. But then to have to put up with social media and then to have to put up with a completely manufactured race situation in a school where you should be focused on biology and science and maths and English. And instead, we're worrying about bullshit that politicians are riding to some kind of public acclaim. The only losers in this situation are going to be school children. And in this case, school girls. We always talk about gender-based violence, take a girl child to work. This seems to be a much, much more dangerous problem on the horizon for so many young women, and no one seems to be looking at it as a problem.
Well, just to start,
they're getting it wrong.
There's no race here. There's no race, and if you want to understand where this all comes from, this comes because originally there was the whole hair issue that happened
in Pretoria,
and that has actually led to this. Because that was in part what happened in the WhatsApp group. So there was a discussion which occurred, which basically said that someone of a black race had said that rules were not fair, And essentially, the discussion in the group was very simple. It just said that I think rules are enforced fairly for everyone. That was the discussion. Most of the girls who've been suspended, by the way, weren't even involved in the discussion.
So
they were just on the group. The discussion was very short, brief, and basically said nothing that can be construed as racist in any way. And that's basically the bottom line of it. But of course, we've got to find something because certain people in the political space, certainly, this is their fuel. That's all they have.
And as I said, like racism is an all-time low in terms of supply. They've got to manufacture it somewhere. I do feel very sorry for these girls. I know that there are currently activities going on in order to not only exonerate them, but there are legal actions that are being perpetuated, which should at least result in some kind of fairness. But I mean,
Gareth, you have to understand there's an entire economic system that's built around this. So the diversity consultants are going to end up making lots of money out of this. They're going to be lawyers on both sides.
Let's just be clear, those people, and we should do a very, very thorough, I'm looking for investigative journalists to actually do their job as investigative journalists. I know it's a tough call, especially you're an acclaimed journalist, aren't you?
Yes.
Jonathan Witt.
Very, very much so.
Looking for them to actually ask the questions about who these diversity consultants are, what their qualifications are, what they're telling people at schools, and how they're helping. Because all I see is destruction in their wake. I don't see anything good coming of any of the stuff that they've done. And I see, again, an opportunity for girls who are always prone to look for a security in a nasty school environment where girls are meaner to each other than boys ever are. Boys have a little fight and then they get over it. Mm-hmm. Girls, if you can find immunity by claiming some kind of injustice, some sort of angle on your gender or race or whatever it is, suddenly you have school immunity, which
is a new superpower.
Yeah. It's every girl's dream. If you're a teenage girl and you can be like, I am impervious to this because I have this card. Jesus, you're handing them a lot of dangerous power. And there's a complete lack of discipline in our schools anyway. My only advice to parents at this point, not that I'm a parent.
Homeschool.
Homeschool. Mm-hmm. Get your kids the hell out of these schools. The government is the last place you should trust the education of your children to.
I mean, I agree with that to an extent, except I would just say that, look, I don't think government should be involved in any of this stuff. I would privatize pretty much everything and just government fund a lot of it. But you know, the other side to say is homeschooling is not practical. I know everyone loves to say homeschooling and it's nice in theory, but homeschooling really is not practical. Even when homeschooling happens in this country, what
just
ends
lazy,
up happening,
Jonathan Witt,
is well, because I have a job, I don't have time to teach a kid. And so what ends up happening with parents who try to homeschool very often is all they do is they create schools. And there actually are plenty of private schools who've come into existence in this way.
And unfortunately, even the private schools are now falling for this woke shit.
So the answer to this is get involved as a parent.
Right.
And if there's a parent teacher's body, get involved.
And make sure that wherever your children are at school, you stand against this bullshit race hustling.
That's right.
This essentially extortion racket.
And do what you're meant to do as a parent, which is take the arrows and slings for your children. And stand
right.
up. And if you get called racist or misogynist
so
or all this crap, who fucking cares?
Yeah, because you're going to be called that anyway.
That's right.
So you're already...
And take it for your kids so that your kid doesn't have to take it.
Correct.
So, that's the answer.
And should your school say, Canthan, that they're going to hire someone as a DEI consultant, what is the best course of action then?
Say, did you spell that correctly?
Now, speaking of...
No, but seriously, let's, Jonathan, to your point, don't just take the view that it means that you've got to be the person that's schooling your people. Because what's happening in lots of neighborhoods around the country right now is that you'll have one person who's usually an ex-teacher who takes responsibility for shepherding these people into his or her home, plonking them down in front of computers and actually supervising their instruction on an ongoing basis.
Yes, yes. And then 5 years later, there's another teacher, and they get into a big building and then ultimately...
No, they don't get into a big building. So Khayelitsha is a very good example of this, where there are private schools now running in Khayelitsha, where parents are paying like 1,000 rand a month to have their kids properly schooled because they don't trust the government schools. And these... are basically, it's been set
this
up.
Such a wonderful
it's been
country.
Set up by teachers who got tired of SATU, and they've bailed from the system.
Right.
probably don't earn as well as they used to, but they're working from home and they don't have to deal with all of the angst of.
But they don't get to sleep with the
what
children.
What are you looking at, Canton?
Now, this is a great opportunity for Canton to show off his book, which is now available in stores.
Oh, the book, yeah. So the book is
you know, fine. Yeah. I try to give you an opportunity here to... I try to give you an opportunity to plug your book.
I'm not the type of person who actually does sales.
It's
one of the reasons why I've never been successful in media.
We've got Canton mirrored here. So there, now you can actually read what the book is called. Not like those lyrics in the 80s. There it actually is the right way around. But Canton, you look very distinguished today. And I do like the soft focus on Jonathan Witt's camera so that it just removes the hard edge. But How to Fix South Africa, available in stores now.
Available in stores now. Well, it's been available in a handful of stores, but now it's basically should be in every major bookstore. And if it's not there, it'll definitely be on their lists, which means that they'll be able to pull it from their warehouses.
All right. So for those people who still haven't figured out how to order things online, that's how you can
That's
do
correct,
it.
Yeah.
All right. Talking of DEI, we're going to go to Kamala Harris in a second. But the other thing that the left absolutely loves, and I'm happy to bring up all the things that the left love this morning because we're just so inclusive ourselves, is this is a great year for Indian Americans. I just want to point out that this is an absolutely stellar year.
Don't get Canton started.
I mean, representation for Indian Americans is at an all-time high. We've got Kamala, who, look, she now says she's not really Indian American. She's now black, as Donald Trump told us in a press conference or an interview he was given by some very hostile woman just here. Very nasty woman yesterday. Kamala's Indian American. Vivek is Indian American. Also likely to be, if Trump is elected, a very important person in the cabinet. I would love to see him dismantle the deep state personally, but we'll see what happens. Nonetheless, a real rising and shining star in the Republican Party. And we've got J.D. Vance's wife, who people didn't know until 3 days ago, but who is now also a quiet, calm, and serene influence on a party that we were told is extremely racist.
She may very well end up being a Supreme Court justice.
Who knows?
Because she's a well-qualified lawyer.
If Kamala does, it would be because she's an Indian American. But if J.D. Vance's wife does, it would be maybe because she's competent.
She was a clerk for the Chief Justice for John Roberts.
And she was a clerk for Kavanaugh on the 11th Circuit, I think.
You two speak as if merit matters. I love that.
yes. Well, we should return.
But it was back from the day when Yale was actually a trusted source of lawyers.
But this is what they're telling us is so important, is racial essentialism. I mean, just this week we had white dudes for Kamala. We had white women for Kamala.
So the Democrats are back into segregation mode.
Absolutely.
So they're straight back into the 1900s.
I believe there's a trans furries for Kamala group as well.
Of course, there will have to be.
There'll be endless
groups,
yes,
right, for Kamala.
But my favorite is the white ladies for Kamala or white chicks for Kamala, whatever they called themselves.
Yes.
And it was the biggest pity party I've ever seen in my life. They had all kinds of these DEI experts, also white savior women.
What J.D. Vance said, right?
Yes.
He called them cat ladies.
Yeah, and they are.
And he did that flippantly in a Fox interview, which
doesn't matter. It's true.
But he made, the point got made for him because then 100,000 of them got together on a Zoom call.
They crashed the call. They were literally shaking. Really?
Yes, they did say they were literally shaking. Yeah. And that's really the issue. He nailed it. And that's why they're so angry about that comment.
We're in danger of getting lost on this, but the Indian American thing, I mean kind of in a flippant and silly way, but it is interesting to me that slowly, for some people, race is becoming less important, but for others, it's becoming the only important thing. And we'll talk about these white liberal women in a minute because they are overwhelmingly Democrats, even from a young age, 12-year-olds apparently, at a rate of 2-1, identifying as Democrats, married people, men and women, overwhelmingly Republican. There doesn't seem to be a race component. It's more like if you're married or you have kids, you're likely to vote Republican. If you are single and a cat lady, you will vote Democrat. That's an interesting breakdown. More interesting to me than like what race people are.
Yeah, so I think... you know, this would have to be investigated and interrogated, and will be over the next sort of two decades, because it's a very real and large voting bloc now. But the thing is you have to, I think you've got to understand the motivations for why people end up there and their life choices, and then their decision on who they vote for. So that grouping you're talking about is voting for a government which is saying, we will be your parents or your husband. Mm. We will look after you. Yeah. That is what we are offering. Right. We are offering to take care of you. Right. You want healthcare? We got it. Right? You go out and sleep with some random guy at a club and get
pregnant. We'll help you get an abortion.
No problem. Yeah. You don't want an abortion in the first 4 months, but you decide 8 months in, I don't want the baby anymore. Not an issue. You don't stress. As long as you give us all your money, we got you sorted. And so that's what's being offered there. If you go to sort of a more social psychology perspective and you read the likes of Gad Saad, he'll tell you straight. You know, those people are looking for someone to be the protector in their life, because traditionally that's what men are.
Or they've had very bad examples of that kind of masculinity.
Oh, well, that too. Yeah. But as I say, it'll need to be interrogated. So I'm lumping a whole group into
We just publicized, and hopefully we'll sell a couple of Canthon's books, but Gad Saad, who I think I've interviewed 3 times and who's terrific, had the biggest endorsement ever by Elon the other day, saying, read The Parasitic Mind.
Yes.
And I would echo that. I think it's a damn fine book.
I think Gad Saad is singly responsible for Elon Musk's turn to what would now be called the right. Yeah. Okay. So Elon was in an interview the other day
about
where he mentioned
his
kid that he basically has no relationship with anymore as a result of what he says being tricked into giving them puberty blockers. And
then confirming that they're in fact sterilization drugs.
And then what happened was he read Gad Saad's book and realize what had happened. And that's why he still refers to all of this and any of it as the woke mind virus. And that comes completely from Gad Saad. And I think that was his kicking off point.
Well, credit to him.
Into all of this.
So what are your comments on all of this? The race essentialism, the fact that people are now separating on the left into these identity groups, which you could call segregation, as Jonathan did. But it's amazing to see this bifurcation.
So a lot of this stuff has been happening for the longest time, but no one has been talking about it. So to talk about Indian Americans, the lesser known fact that people don't talk about is that they are the highest earning income group in the United States right now. So they are the highest earning income group. Chinese Americans are up there.
And Nigerian Americans.
And Ethiopian Americans are way up there as well. So, you know, America is this racist country where you can come in as an Indian American, a Nigerian American.
And Koreans.
And Koreans as well. But Koreans are pretty much white, Jonathan.
So are Jews, aren't you?
Who
knows where the Jews are? We've got to get
depends
to Honey.
Who wants to hate
Listen,
us.
We're going to do a little yili-li-li-li just now because they managed to take out an absolutely despicable human being
the race
in Iran.
Baiting,
we'll get there.
But the race baiting really takes place at the level of Black Americans, because historically, by persuading Black Americans that they're a victim bloc, the Democrats have been able to keep them pretty much trapped.
And by persuading white Americans, and particularly white liberal women here, and I don't want to be beating up on them because a lot of these people have serious problems. But
well, they've been beaten up on,
It's the guilt. It's the guilt that seems to – I mean, if you watch just 5 seconds of any of the clips that have been doing the rounds about that Karens for Kamala thing – it's just incredible how there's this kind of masochism, which is allied very closely to the savior complex. You know, it's like these white ladies really believe that they're there to save blacks and black women especially, and people of color, you know, indigenous people. Mm-hmm. They see themselves as kind of the Joan of Arc of the 2020 somethings, and no one is calling them to order. They get into this weird spiral of like convincing themselves. You can hear them kind of, yeah, that's right, sister. It's the most bizarre thing. And it's no wonder to me that most of these women are unmarriable.
Well, two things. One is on the Indian Americans who are doing so well. And, you know, you've mentioned politicians. But if you look at heads of Google, for example, yeah. same thing. You know, a lot of the Silicon Valley guys are Indian Americans or come from an Indian background. I think one of the reasons is because none of them are interested in race. You will battle to find any clips or any interviews in which those people have spoken about their race.
Canton's brought this up before, so I must give him credit. But it is a remarkable thing to see that almost singularly, wherever Indians who have emigrated from India or over the 150, 200 years of what we've known as migratory patterns, wherever Indians go, their chief purpose is to assimilate into that society, as opposed to what a lot of other cultures seem to do, in that they choose absolutely not to. We see this in Europe, for example. But it is uniquely an Indian immigrant characteristic that they want to be a part of the society they moved into. Otherwise, why be there?
But you assimilate without actually losing what your culture is all about, which is the way immigration is supposed to work.
Yes.
That you actually add to the fabric of society rather than trying to tear it apart. But there's an interesting juxtaposition of stuff that's happening here right now, which actually ties in a lot of this together. So there's been a plea bargain that has now been reached with the people who have been held on Guantanamo Bay for more than 20 years now. I mean, they've been held there since 2003. The three guys who were the purported masterminds behind the September 11th attack.
Mm-hmm.
And they've now decided to plead guilty in exchange for not having a death penalty imposed on them.
After 20 years.
after 20 years. But if you track back to that time of September 11th actually happening, and this is a point that Peter Thiel has been talking about recently, it became fashionable at that point to enforce atheism as a very good thing. Mm-hmm. Because by being atheist, it would allow you to be anti-Islamic. And I say this as an atheist myself.
Mm-hmm.
But it allowed them to then be able to go after primarily the perpetrators of 9/11. But it also then became a proxy for the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, and everything else that happened in the Middle East under the you could mask what was essentially a campaign against Islam on the basis of atheism. But at the same time, if you are propping up atheism within that framework 20 years ago, and you fail to recognize that what fundamentally built your society is in fact religion, and in the case of the United States, it was Christianity, and you undermine that fabric at the same time of Christianity within your own country, and then 20 years later, you wonder why there is no social cohesion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fascinating point.
It is a very good point. I mean, I remember being caught up in all of that at the time. I knew that September 11th was an attack on civilization. It occurred to me immediately, mm-hmm. the moment I saw those planes going into those buildings. And I could identify that the enemy of civilization at that point was fundamentalist Islam.
Yes.
Right. Hmm. And I was happy to say that, but I was also caught up in the fact that religion has done an enormous amount of damage. I was buoyed along by the writing, the speaking, and the work of people like Christopher Hitchens, who were preeminent in intellectual circles and who managed to absolutely destroy any argument brought against them, often with some humor, which I liked a lot. Those people, I think, are also waking up. You see little bits of it happening with Dawkins at the moment, where he's starting to say things which he was afraid to say 5 or 6 years ago. I don't think that there's anything wrong with admitting that people like to clothe what could be seen as a prejudice. And, you know, I don't want anyone to ever think that I'm anti-Islamic people, but there are certainly things about the religion of Islam which worry and concern me as someone who believes in civilization. And for that reason, I think it was a convenient cloak for many people. They're now starting to realize that it was insufficient for the purposes of combating a destruction of civilization. And what we've unfortunately done among our allies is we've also realized that a lot of them have replaced religion with a fervent leftism, which is another kind of religion.
So this is the problem, is that essentially, you know, on this point around atheism, is that it's fine, believe whatever you want to believe or don't believe, as it were. However, the problem is if you're Dawkins and your IQ is 160 and you're not only able to, but you are forced by the way your brain works to rationalize everything, and you're able to do that, then atheism works for you because you don't need a belief system in something greater. And when there is nothing else there, it's okay. The vacuum is not filled by anything. The problem is that...
In steps government.
Well, the problem is that for many people, if you remove God and you remove all the things that come along with that, it's not just removing God. It's removing religion. It's removing community that religion creates often. It's all of those things.
Well, it's the scaffolding.
When you remove those things... The majority are going to be unable to replace or leave that space empty. They're going to fill it with something. And so what has happened for the left is that they filled it with something. And Marxism is a religion. Communism is the heaven they're trying to get to. All right. So Marxism is the text and communism is the utopia. I don't care what you think about religious people and if you think they're dumb and stupid and you want to say all these things. I mean, I always thought that it was a bit of a straw man on the part of Dawkins and Sam Harris. The problem is they took it literally. So they'd read something in the Bible and they'd go, oh, you see, the Bible says you can't wear clothing that's got two types of threads in it. And are you stupid? Are you idiots? And they never bothered to consider what the spiritual meaning of any of the religions are, what it means to people to exist in the world and understand why good things happen, why bad things happen, how people rationalize those things, especially if you aren't a person who's a professor at a university.
But it's a fundamental problem, John, right now in terms of the absence of storytelling and metaphor in our day-to-day lives, which is fundamentally what all religion is about.
Mm-hmm.
And you understand the importance of metaphor in this particular case.
Absolutely, and your place in the universe, your place on Earth, because everybody at some point realizes, you know, you go through your 20s and you think you're bulletproof. Mm-hmm. Nothing will kill you. And most of us, I think all men look back on their 20s and think to themselves, wow, I don't know how I didn't die. Okay, we all did incredibly, either die or was arrested, or didn't kill one of my friends by mistake, obviously. But like, we did such stupid things as young men.
I would routinely drive from Johannesburg to Durban in less than 4 hours.
I was driving on the highway at very, very great speeds, sometimes quite inebriated.
Those sort of things and silly things you did at 4 a.m. after coming home with your mates.
God. Things you would do to get laid. Are you kidding?
Absolutely. So, and you think nothing bad can happen to you. And then at some point you realize there's this thing called mortality. And then life starts becoming a lot different in terms of how you view the world.
And well, you become a parent, John, and that's the point at which you really grow up.
Absolutely. So, that's a point J.D. Vance has made recently about parents, is that children change you. And people who don't have kids have been very offended by this. Yeah. And I don't think there's a need to be offended by that. It's true. It does change your perspective.
Yeah, I also think that they've made a huge meal out of him saying, you know, single cat ladies and people who choose not to have children are missing out on things, because I don't think you have to be upset by this stuff. I mean, you can choose not to. I do feel sorry for the people who can't have children for various reasons, but those are the minority of the people who are choosing not to these days.
Yes.
I think there are a huge number of people who are just doing it because it's selfish.
Well, there's a lot of people who don't want to have kids now because I know people who've said to me, I don't want to have kids because the world's a bad place. I mean, what?
I don't like that argument.
Climate change. You know, I'm contributing to climate change.
Okay. I do want to take us back a step because we've just got... And this is great. We've only spent half an hour, which is terrific. We've still got more time. I have a feeling this is going to be one of those episodes that's going to upset pretty much everyone at some point, but that's okay. Let's just focus in, since we brought up Islam and this God-shaped hole that so many people are dealing with in the West. There isn't that God-shaped hole in the Middle East, but there are certain divisions that are starting to make themselves quite evident. It was amazing this week that Israel pulled off this absolutely, I mean, it's a phenomenal and courageous thing. It's also extremely dangerous what they've done. And in Iran, to take out Ismail Haniyeh, the head of Hamas, to take out one of the major leaders in Hezbollah in Beirut, I mean, it really is quite something. They could not have done this, perhaps without the help of the Saudis. And again, maybe they could have. I'm not going to speculate on that for too long. We don't know the answers. But You know, Saudi Arabia is changing at an extraordinarily rapid pace. It was always the ultimate place of like backward Wahhabism and the most staunch forms of Islam. And now under Mohammed bin Salman, it seems to be making strides forward that I don't know that anyone has ever seen this kind of change happen so dramatically in one lifetime.
Well, I think, you know, all of this, in my opinion, gets misconstrued. So Mohammed bin Salman is a reformer and he really cares about reforming sort of the religion and the way the religion's practiced. I just think he looks at the Middle East and goes, we have a fundamental problem here, and that is economics. Pragmatism. It's economics, yeah. Okay? It's the same reason Israel exists, by the way. Israel doesn't exist because they really believe the Jews should have a state. I mean, please. Israel exists because there's an economic argument for Israel to exist. And that economic argument often for the Americans, for example, boils down to military hardware.
As Canton says, all wars are trade wars.
There you go. So there's an economics argument for Israel to exist. And as the only democracy in the Middle East and as a bulwark of the West in the Middle East, economically, that makes sense. And then politically, that follows. Saudi Arabia, for me, is a similar thing. He looks at the Middle East and he sees Qatar not reforming, but becoming certainly a powerhouse of some sort, and it's anti-Saudi. Then he sees what the UAE has done, still with a dictator in charge, right? It's still ruled with an iron fist. You don't step out of line in the UAE. Yeah. However, if you go there as any other person, it looks like a Western country.
Welcoming.
In fact, it looks like the future of a Western country. Yeah. So he looks at that and goes, okay, where is Saudi Arabia in this? That's their whole thing about building that line in the desert, that silly building they want to build. That's their thing. It's like, we want to be part of this future. Mm-hmm. And he knows that he cannot be part of that future without reforming some of the more backward ideas that exist in Saudi Arabia.
And perhaps the most backward idea is that Israel shouldn't exist.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense, again, economically, to not be a friend of that trade partner, especially when that friend is enemies of your enemy. So, you know, that's...
But let's talk about this assassination thing, because...
You won't like it, I know.
So there was something... I don't know how many of you guys watched Netanyahu's presser yesterday.
No,
I didn't.
Okay, so, well I did. And he spoke at length about taking out Hezbollah's number two.
Did he say, we took him out like a dog?
He died like a dog. No, he didn't. But not a word was mentioned about Iran. And the fascinating thing for me in terms of what went down in Iran is that there's a lot of things that actually don't add up. So now let's just give us a bit of a backdrop out here. Firstly, Haneh is a billionaire, literally.
Yes, $4 billion he stole.
We know this. That secondly, that most of his family has been wiped out already. Now, we also know that historically, Iran has been very antagonistic towards Hamas. They have always supported Hezbollah and they've supported the Houthis, but they've always been antagonistic.
They still supported them, Kenton. They have Iranian
Jonathan,
weapons.
Jonathan, you and I can have this argument till we blue in the face, but now I want you to hear my conspiracy theory.
Okay.
Which ultimately ends up coming true in a couple of weeks' time. So let's just park that for a second. What I find fascinating is that firstly, you have a sufficient level of intelligence within the part of Israeli intelligence to be able to recognize that this guy happens to be staying in this particular guest house, in this particular room, to be able to get there and to be able to take him out. It's a very different thing if it's a missile strike, which was the case in Beirut. That you can understand immediately how the guy gets taken out. What if this was an opportunity for Iran to move a very specific piece that was a point of irritation off the board, especially since you have a new president that's just come in Iran? Okay, so that's one potential conspiracy theory. The second potential conspiracy theory is that he's not dead. He just chose an opportunity to disappear because he can see what is actually going down right now in terms of Israel systematically taking out everyone at the upper echelons. But we don't have any backstory right now. It's not like the raid on Entebbe.
All right. I mean, it's not outlandish.
He's on the island with the possessor guy. Yeah.
Well, I saw an incredible tweet this morning. Guy arrived here much too early. I was very worried about traffic for some reason. And I saw a tweet from somebody who said, you know, Haniyeh lived like a Palestinian and died like a Palestinian. Someone replied, he was born in Egypt and died in Iran. Do me a favor. So, yes, that place is also full of, just like everywhere else in the world, performative politicians, right? And we don't know. We were told that Joe Biden was absolutely great by Kamala and by Barack Obama and by all the other people who've just knifed him in the back. We were told just a few days, nay, a few hours before he was unceremoniously disposed of and thrown in the trash can of politics by these people that he was the most sharp guy ever.
And he was still running. Oh, absolutely.
Totally. He even said
so. I am the party's nominee. Definitely. I am the party.
This is the best version of Joe Biden ever.
Right. Yes. And the media were backing them up on that. I think that all of this can be tied together. The God-shaped hole, the Middle East situation. We could bring in Russia and Ukraine to certainly American politics and even to some degree our local politics. In the fact that ordinary people just don't trust the politicians, the media, and general consensus polling and all that other stuff anymore. Those things have been reduced to such a level of discredit that they are now a millstone around the neck of anyone who believes in them proffers. I really don't think that this is so much about whether or not you're on this side or on that side, whether you believe in racial essentialism or in, you know, fundamentalist Christianity. I think it's down to we're just either tired of being lied to, or you're prepared to just keep pretending that the lying is okay.
Yeah, so this
those
for
are
me,
two sides.
I think that's roughly correct. For me, it's all about narratives. And this is what I realized. This is the changing moment I had in COVID, which is that I realized that everything is driven by narrative. And I don't know what the number is, whether it's 50 plus one, whether it's lower than that, just 30% plus of the population, whatever it is. If enough people believe whatever the main narrative is, that is the truth, unfortunately, like it or not. And so what's happening
it's like J.D. Vance's sofa.
It's yes. What's happening as a result of that is as a result of social media and just people turning and realizing the narrative is ridiculous because it just doesn't make sense, is slowly you're getting a collapse of the number of people who believe in the narrative. Now, we haven't gotten to the point yet where that whole thing falls to pieces, but you did see – so you see breaks –
it's breaking off like the icebergs that they tell us are breaking off.
Or it's almost like Event Horizon. You're seeing like you're almost reaching it, and at points you see like you see through the black hole. Because with Trump assassination, for example,
yeah,
that was a moment where you saw beyond the event horizon, where suddenly for about 24 hours, most people were like, "Holy crap! The guy got shot in the ear, / the head." Right. Mm-hmm. And missed being dead by 3 centimeters. And he went down, had blood on his face, and 30 seconds later was standing up, pumping his fist in the air, saying, "Fight, fight, fight." That is completely against the narrative of who Trump is.
Well, they're trying to memory hole that.
Because of what I'm saying, which is that is probably the strongest anti-narrative moment that has happened in the past 20 years. And so the thing now is if you get a collapse of the general narrative, so if the narrative around Trump, for example, collapses, he's a bad person, he's a white supremacist, he's black, he's a racist, you know, all of these, he's corrupt,
a woman abuser,
all of these things, right?
Yeah.
If the narrative collapses, that is huge, especially on a person around a person like that, around which so much of what the current narrative is, certainly in politics, has been built. And so that's where we are. We're at either you believe the narrative or you don't believe. We have narratives all over the place. Cyril is the best person to run the ANC, even though the ANC is bad. Except Cyril is a communist, and he's probably the worst person to run the ANC. Paul Mashatile is terrible. Except Paul Mashatile ruled over Gauteng when Gauteng was in its prime. frankly. Mm. We got the Gautrain thanks to Paul Mashatile. You can argue and tell me about corruption. Yeah, there's no ANC member who seems to be at an upper level who isn't corrupt. I'm not arguing corruption. I'm arguing who would be the best in that position. We have narratives all over the show. So that's a South African political narrative. We had COVID narratives. Masks protect you. You know, you must get the jab.
So on this, and this is where I really want some of Canton's input too, because you've had a long career in the media and you've been skeptical when necessary and you've been supportive when necessary of like the Fourth Estate, right? Which we've been really, this is one major untested thing. And I get into constant arguments with people who have a vested interest in this because they're in the media business. What do you think the future holds for all of these corrupt agencies and outlets and platforms that have been selling us this bullshit for so long, with corporate money backing them, with government infiltrating them, with unions telling them what to do in this country,
and NGOs
and NGOs all over the world? It seems to me like it's so poetic that even Fox News, who no one on the left can stand, sometimes for very good reason, fires Tucker Carlson, their most successful person. He's now got a bigger podcast than Joe Rogan even. And the first reaction from most people is, oh, well, podcasts are all right wing. Instead of, how has the left fucked up so badly that someone like Tucker can make a greater success and reach more people independently than he did on the wings of these huge corporations, which seemingly were impervious to criticism for so long?
Well, let's be very clear. The only reason why any of this is now taking place is because of the fact that Musk bought Twitter. Because if he had not done so, this entire process that we are seeing in the rest of the media, the memory holding that Jonathan was talking about, would actually be the defining narrative. And Tucker was essentially able to claw out that particular niche based on the fact that he ended up with, 70 million views on his Putin interview. Mm. So it's absolutely unreal in terms of the volume.
Didn't Hillary call him a traitor?
So,
but Hillary calls everyone a traitor. Yeah. She called Tulsi Gabbard a traitor.
Meanwhile, the traitor's right in her bed.
But the thing that we don't understand,
is joking? She looks in the mirror. I mean, please.
Oh, that's quite right. Of course, they don't share a bed.
Benghazi. I mean, it's banned, that word, in the Clinton household.
Something that we forget is that there is really no difference between Fox and CNN. We need to be clear about this because ultimately all of them pay allegiance to the deep state in the form of the neocons. And Murdoch fundamentally
and has always
been. So you want to create enough of a sense of, guys, sorry for this, but it just so happens that my colleagues are now cracking themselves up with laughter.
I'll tell you why.
An inappropriate meme.
Someone just sent me a picture of a Soviet gender reveal of Chernobyl blowing up, and they go, "It's a worker." So I thought, you know, since we've had a go at communists today,
which is
that
the
would
only
probably
gender
be,
in no, the Soviet Union.
Sorry to interrupt you, though. You were on a useful line of thought.
Yeah, but the useful line of thought is, you know, take the view that the likes of Murdoch's establishment and the likes of CNN, they're not really different, because what they do is they create the impression that there's a free dialogue going on. But you have to keep to the core narrative. And the core narrative ultimately is going to be the likes of Benghazi. It is going to be the likes of ensuring that the state has control at every conceivable level. And it's not only there. You know, case in point is what happened in the UK, where you suddenly have a landslide victory for
Labour.
But guess what? You know, this guy is even more Boris Johnson than Boris Johnson was.
And it's such a meh thing. Most people couldn't be bothered. It's like in this country, most people couldn't have been bothered to go and vote. Let's try something really ambitious here. Let's try to construct the meta narrative. And I think you got close to it just now, where you said what religion used to do for people is it used to provide them with a story, their place, their time, what their history is, what goodness and evil look like. And you've got a competing story, these constructed narratives by politically ambitious and mostly intellectually vapid people. And you've got these two things contesting for a place of prominence in most people's minds. Who's going to win? Because for the last little while, I mean, I was pretty down about this kind of thing happening 2016 to 2018. It looked like it was an insurmountable and unassailable force for the narratives that people were building. You know, you had just a total collapse of anything that felt like truth or that could be proven to be true, because facts didn't matter for the longest time. And I somehow get the idea now that slowly but surely those event horizon moments that Jonathan was talking about, that piercing of the veil, is starting to happen more and more. Am I being misled? Am I not paying attention closely enough? Or is it suddenly time for history to do what it does so very often, and that is to have that cycle moment where we were at the bottom of truth being on any kind of important, it was beyond the grasp of most people because everything seemed like it was a lie. And we're starting to suddenly see people find truth again.
So the meta-narrative that people are not talking about is the economic one. Okay. And the economic one fundamentally traces itself back to the hegemony of the US dollar for the past 50 years. And the US dollar for the past 50 years has been the biggest con in the history of the human race.
That because wasn't a throat clearing. That was, you were ready to spit there.
I was ready to spit. Yeah.
Okay, tell me more.
Yeah. So if you take the view that up until the time of Richard Nixon decoupling the US dollar from any real intrinsic value, mm-hmm. which is effectively gave them a license to print money. Mm-hmm. And he then put in the second phase, which is to insist that you could only buy fuel, as in
dollars,
crude oil in US dollars, which was then enforced with gunboat diplomacy. And that has pretty much been the norm for the past 50 years. Effectively, what that has meant is that if you consider that at the time of the decoupling, I was a kid at the time, and it was 75 South African cents to a US dollar. Now, if you look in terms of the fundamental productive capacity of South Africa, has it in fact changed? And the answer to that is no. You know, we're still mining stuff. We're still producing stuff. But why has the price of that gone down? Because by artificially manipulating the currency levels, you're able to actually force a situation where you're able to then buy out countries. So with the current situation where people are dependent on US dollars, what does it cost to buy the South African government? So if you want to distribute 500 million rand to every single ANC politician in order to be able to get them to go with Ramaphosa's vision to actually align with the Americans, which is pretty much what's happened with the GNU. That's what, $20 million?
It's nothing.
It's nothing in order to be able to buy out a country, which is why...
Or to make us put up windmills and solar panels everywhere.
All of that kind of stuff. Now, what you are seeing happening right now, and this is where the rest of BRICS comes into it, because now effectively, if you take BRIC without South Africa, that effectively is the world's biggest economy. Mm-hmm. It's not the West anymore. Mm-hmm. It's now they've now pretty much overtaken the West. But more to the point, they've now been putting in place mechanisms to be able to trade on the basis of fair value that's actually determined between the country, which means that you're extricating the US dollar from the global monetary system. And at the point at which that happens, the ability of the US to then control the narrative around the rest of the world falls apart, which is why right now we're closer to World War III than we ever have been.
It was starting to sound good up to there. No,
it goes back to the whole thing that I keep saying, that all wars are trade wars.
So on that note, the only place that we haven't gone in the world yet, because you brought up BRICS, which conveniently brings India and China into the mix, and Russia. But Russia and the Ukraine, I mean, this thing, it looked like it was going to carry on forever. And I heard in your part as well that you mentioned that for the first time ever, Trump had a meeting with Zelensky, not as president, but as president and candidate, and probably said to him, look, you know, if I become president, we're going to close the taps.
Yeah,
meaning that Zelensky for the first time has to countenance an end to the war.
Let's be clear. Even if Kamala becomes president,
There's no appetite.
She's going to close the taps as well.
Right.
Biden can't close the taps now because if he closes the taps now, that's admitting defeat.
So as an actor, Zelensky is now going to act like he wants peace.
Well, Zelensky, Zelensky wanted peace. So this is, let's remember, in 2021, was it
2022?
No, it was 2021, I think, was that conference. It was 8 months
he
or
was
so.
He was saying this is not going to end until we get back everything.
I don't remember the exact yeah. date, but essentially Boris Johnson goes off to Minsk, was mm-hmm. it? Goes off to Minsk, and they have a peace deal. They have a peace deal on the table. It's drawn up. The Ukrainians, in principle, are in agreement. The Russians, in principle, are in agreement. The deal goes something to the levels of, look, you get Luhansk and Donetsk, and we all go back home, basically, and we stop fighting with each other.
It would have been Boris's Neville Chamberlain moment.
And yes. Well, you could argue that it wasn't a Neville Chamberlain moment because it would have, if you understand the dynamics in Ukraine and Russia, it may have been a good deal.
And a lasting peace.
You know, it's okay. More like a Versailles Treaty than that.
It's a Clemenceau moment.
But, okay. But the point is that Boris Johnson flies in and under the instruction of Joe Biden or the American administration, because Joe Biden hasn't been running anything for 4 years.
Probably Karine Jean-Pierre, for all we know.
Who knows? Some 22-year-old who studied political science says you need to scupper this deal. And they do exactly that. They go back. They were literally going to sign the deal the next day. And the next day, the Ukrainians turned around and said, absolutely not, under no circumstances.
And then their chief negotiator was assassinated in Kiev.
I hate to bring just ordinary human feelings to this, but what level of cynicism, what level of disconnection from your humanity do you have to be so cynical that you'd be willing to put hundreds of thousands of people in the way of certain death?
Mm-hmm.
And so many corpses already piling up in this conflict in order to scupper the deal for domestic political advantage. This is extraordinary. I mean, there cannot be a more evil way of looking at the world than this. I'm sorry.
But it's not cynical. It's the way the world works, because humans have an innate nature to, and this is evolutionary, to not care about anyone outside of our tribe. This is how we are built. So if you're an American, you may very well care about Americans. And so we know this, Americans do. When American troops die, Americans get upset. Even if it's 13 who get blown up on Joe Biden's withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Otherwise, put them in the meat grinder.
Otherwise, no problem. No. But they don't care about Ukrainians. They couldn't care less about 600,000 Ukrainians. Mm. That's why the Ukraine war is not a main topic of the election. It does not rank in the top five issues at all.
But the money being spent.
But the money. So this is, you ask how, where's the cynicism? It's not cynicism. If you are Nancy Pelosi and you know that this war continuing makes you, the Democratic Party, and all of your kids who sit on the boards of every single one of those weapons manufacturers rich beyond their wildest dreams, and all you have to do is perpetuate a war for 3 or 4 years in which you continually approve billions of dollars of aid to Ukraine, and then the majority of that money, some of which gets siphoned off by Zelensky and his mates to buy cabins in the Swiss Alps, and the rest gets paid back to your weapons companies, which you are all invested in / work for. This is a win-win. And it also helps with Bidenomics, because you fuck the country up by increasing the debt trap by 50%. But at the same time, not a problem. Money's coming in. So we have manufacturing, and manufacturing is going up through the roof. And where do these weapons companies have their factories? Oh, it turns out in the Rust Belt, where we need votes. So, you know, this is a win-win if you're an American politician at the highest levels, and they don't care about dead Ukrainians or dead Russians or whether the world gets to the point of World War III, because they truly believe that they can stop what happens when that first nuclear weapon goes off. And they are
I'm suddenly having a flashback to one of the Trump jokes that was doing around about 2016, where Trump was saying, Gareth, you could probably do this imitation. Well, I can't do his voice.
I feel like that's my only contribution to this morning's show.
but Trump's thing was, I'm going to kill 600 million Muslims in one blonde. And they ask him, but why one blonde? And he says, you see, no one cares about the Muslims.
Yeah.
And this is to your point, right. Jonathan. Interesting, guys, that, you know, I just want to tie back to the earlier point around religion and social cohesion, and take the view that at the point at which Russia went through the entire communist phase, which basically ripped out the underpinnings of religion and social cohesion in terms of the class structures and all of that, and it fell apart and it became an utter basket case. And I think that if you take a look in terms of the resurgence of Russia as a strong economic power in the world, the glue that has actually held that together was the reinforcement of the position of the Russian Orthodox Church in terms of the fabric of society across the board. And that is now such a key point in terms of what defines what Russia is all about and pulls them together. You know, Putin pitching up at every religious ceremony, an example. You cut across to China, and, you know, whatever you may say about China, the fabric of religion in that country is so incredibly strong. And again, you go back in terms of what's been happening in India under Modi, where there's been a strong push away from secularism, and he's been reinforcing the idea of India is actually a majority Hindu state, and we're going to be proud of that, and we're going to embrace it. And in the meanwhile, you've had exactly the opposite happening in the West, where you've been pulling apart that fabric, and you're seeing economic degradation.
Mm-hmm. And let me bring that back to South Africa, because before the elections, I said that the biggest mistake that DA was making was not courting the vote of the Zionist Christian Church, because everybody in this country was terrified of coming out in support of Israel. But the largest religious group in this country is in support of Israel. And if they had just gone and embraced that group, they would have picked up potentially millions of voters. But everyone is too terrified. You either have to stand in the middle on the fence and be like, look, we don't really want to comment on that, which was the DA's essential position. We believe in a two-state solution. That's their boilerplate rubbish. Or you have to be on the ANC side, and Israel's committing a genocide. And so, you know, but at the same time, on the ground, the majority of people in South Africa are Christian. And a majority of those Christians are supportive of Israel, whether you like that or not.
And politically conservative. Okay. So with your indulgence, we're over 8 o'clock, but I think there are one or two things I still want you to comment on, both of you. South America is a very interesting place at the moment. I mean, we've been talking about Milei in Argentina, which is one kind of story. And there's El Salvador, which is technically Central America, but still an interesting case in point. And then there's Venezuela, okay, which Juarez and Jack and I were bemoaning on our show yesterday.
Because Juarez is bloody hilarious.
Yeah, it used to produce the most beautiful women in the world, Venezuela. At every beauty pageant, if Venezuela was in, everyone else was out. And now it's reduced to a country of beggars and dog eaters and just the most terrible destruction of society, the economy. People are just flooding out at a rate never before seen from a country that has actually got such natural resources and was a very happy society, was the richest country in South America for a very long time.
Yes.
And Maduro has just been reelected. Stunningly, if they add up all the votes, it comes to 107%. But
also the turnout is incredible.
But I do think, again, on this truth bullshit axis that we've built, the fact that he is terrified that Elon Musk is going to fly in there and actually fight with him,
yeah, but
just shows you how deranged that regime must be. These are the descendants of the Chavez regime, which I know our local EFF and even some members of the ANC regard very highly as a perfect example of how society should eventually move. What are your comments on South America and these absolutely insane contrasts that are going on in a continent which mostly is a side issue to most people.
So I think the prevailing view among most people is that Maduro is basically a commie bastard and he should be taken out. And, you know, there are times where I probably have that view myself. But, you know, one of the things that I keep going back to is that the way in which right now we look at these things.
Oh, if only Pinochet were there with a helicopter or two.
Yeah, well, but Maduro,
and a soccer stadium or two in order to be able to bury 30,000 people and then plow it over in the middle of the night. You know, if nothing else.
We're guys, calling for violence. Is that calling for?
No, all I'm saying is
we're
that
just if nothing historic else, facts.
In the case of Pinochet, okay, you've got to appreciate the sheer engineering skill in being able to plow an entire.
Some of them went into the jungle, Kevin.
To plow an entire soccer field.
Food for jaguars.
Fill it with bodies. Jeez. And cover it up overnight. Okay, I mean, that's
horrific.
Yeah.
Okay, but Maduro is a bus driver.
Guys, let's just get back to a fundamental point out here. The point at which Chavez became a target was the point at which he began flooding the market with oil. And let's remember that Venezuela has probably the greatest untapped reserves of oil in the world right now. Well, that have been discovered to date. And John, you and I know that there's lots of oil off our shores, for example.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say we might be the greatest untapped because they're at least a little bit.
But instead, we're filling the Eastern Cape, which I was in the other day, with these fucking windmills that are killing all our birds and making the place look like the Day of the Triffids.
It's a great book.
You're showing your age by that reference.
It's a good reference,
Gareth.
Sorry.
But something that we need to be clear about, guys, and it's never been more clear than in the past 2 years as a direct result of the Ukraine war, that sanctions distort the way in which countries actually operate. And so you have this fundamental breakdown in the fabric of society, economically speaking, in Venezuela. But let's be very clear that the impact of sanctions in terms of being able to perpetuate and reinforce that situation. This point is not being made by enough people because it's a kind of distorted situation. And we saw it happen in the case of Liz Truss, when Liz Truss tried to mess with the economic fundamentals of the way in which the UK economy was working. The Americans just basically crashed the economy. How did the Americans crash the economy? Well, it's because the reason why the pound actually exists at the level that it does is because the U.S. maintains it at that level based on currency swaps. And all they did was...
Are you blaming the U.S. for everything, Canton?
Well, I'm certainly saying that in the case of Venezuela, would I vote for Maduro? Do I think that the people of Venezuela don't deserve Maduro? The answer to that, absolutely, yes.
It's a commie bastard.
He's a commie bastard. But at the same time...
I want to add to
this. But at the same time, let's be very clear that we have not had a level playing field there in order to be able to see whether Venezuela's economic model actually works. And I want to just duck back to Afghanistan as a case in point.
I want to go back to this point you're making.
Okay, I want to go to Afghanistan. And the crucial thing for me in terms of Afghanistan, and let's be very clear, I hate the Taliban. Okay, I think that the greatest...
Very controversial statement.
No.
What's not to love?
The idea of taking every girl child out of school is the most repulsive thing
that's
happened.
Well, if you join Karens for Kamala, you'd also want girls to not go to school.
So,
that's what happens when you educate them
and
give them the vote.
But here's what's happened since the...
Taliban makes a very good point.
But here's what's happened since the Taliban came in.
Yeah.
Okay. More than 80% of the opium production in that country has been destroyed. Okay, they've wiped it out.
Say no to drugs.
Yes, it's saying no to drugs. And essentially, that production absolutely blossomed during the 20 years of U.S. occupation. It became the primary export from Afghanistan.
Okay.
And so my point is that when we have the situation where economics of a country gets distorted based on sanctions that get imposed from other countries. And my experience in Zimbabwe is another case in point around that. I hesitate to say that the primary problem is here, whereas there's actually a regime change incentive behind the scenes.
So let me put that all together because I don't agree. So I agree that sanctions don't work. I will. I'm with you on that.
Catherine's saying they do.
I'm saying they do work.
That well worked to do what?
No, that is the primary. That is the primary influence on why these countries fail.
So no. So. The reason why Venezuela failed is because Hugo Chavez took that oil, all that oil stuff, said I'm gonna nationalize it, and of course government, as we know, does everything better than the private sector, and then that absolutely failed, along with his plundering of state funds. And then yes, it is true that sanctions would have fiddled with all of that. And then what happens is Chavez dies unexpectedly, and Maduro is a moron. So it's the same as South Africa, right? You have a situation where we inherited. So in South Africa, our policy is Leninism. Okay, yeah. We inherited Soviet era policy. Some of the stuff, the ANC's documents still to today have some of the stuff that is Soviet documentation
that even the Soviets are embarrassed.
That even right, that Russia is completely abandoned. And but what happened is
the ANC hasn't upgraded its software since the 70s.
But the thing is that the guys that originally put that into place actually understood what they were doing in terms of that system. We have now had idiots to follow that, which is why we have communists who have no idea what they're doing, thank goodness, and are incompetent at implementing this. Okay. Mm-hmm. What you had
in Exhibit A, China.
What you had in Afghanistan, is you had a logistics system. So the reason why there was an opium market in Afghanistan was because the Americans were there to bring democracy to the Middle East. And so what they did was they went there to fight anyone who fought them. But if you wanted to grow a whole bunch of drugs and then use the American military to transport them to the rest of the world, which is exactly what happened, because the minute the Americans withdrew from Afghanistan, the minute, the amount of opium available in the world dropped by the 80% Canton's talking about. The reason why there's no opium coming out of Afghanistan is because the logistics networks, turns out they don't have that many C-130s in Afghanistan, because the Americans didn't leave that many behind.
He left a few, and it's just they can't fly them.
C-130s, he left Black Hawk helicopters.
Yeah. It's like dropping an iPhone in Cro-Magnon times.
The point is they're not, there's not 30 C-130s flying from background.
I love Percy's comment here. We've got to give credit where it's due. Sometimes the comment section is the best part of this show. ANC is running MS-DOS.
Listen, guys, CrowdStrike crashed most of Windows the other day. MS-DOS worked just fine. Thank you very much.
So you've come out of this morning's show, Canton, being very pro-religion. Well, certainly your observation is that religion is back.
I'm saying that religion provides a fabric to society.
No, but it's back. And, wherever it's being, wherever it is the underpinning of the society, it seems those societies are again flourishing.
It's great to success.
Wherever they're destroying that, the society is diminishing in concert with it.
Yes, pretty much.
This is very bad news for atheists like me. Very, very bad news. We're forced to go back to basics and figure out whether or not we were completely misled.
We haven't been misled. But Gareth, the point is that
I'm willing to take the hit and do some homework.
You and I, as atheists, we've never been bashing religion.
I definitely did.
Which is an entirely different thing.
I definitely did. I'm glad to say I stopped doing that a short while ago.
And it was freaking hilarious. I mean, he got suspended for interviewing Jesus. It was wonderful.
Yeah. Look, what I think is that probably we've become reluctant bedfellows, because I look at the religious people all over the world, in particular the moderate religions, the ones that have spent a lot of time introspecting and perhaps reforming and having revolutions within their movement, and science breaking off and all the rest of it. And I see the people who follow those as probably people who I'm not morally or ethically opposed to on any major axis, but I'm more pleased by the fact that I would be allied to them against what I see as secular leftism. And that is a greater threat to what I consider to be the valuable civilization I'd like to take part in, to be a part of, to contribute to. If I'm forced to choose between secular leftism or a conservative religious society, I think I'm going to choose a conservative religious society. As someone who's been a very vocal atheist for a long time. That's a realization, that's a development, I hope, an improvement in my character over the last few years. But I think that many people are struggling with what is the pole that we nail our colors to, the mast that we need to put our flag on.
But do we need one?
Well, people kind of do need something to believe in. And I think for many, particularly young people in the world today, you can see it in voter turnout in our own election. You can see it all over the world. There's this lack of passion for anything except being able to live comfortably, which is not a reason to exist. That's
or being a dink, double income, no kids.
Yeah, not really.
That's a thing.
You're like, what are you going to do? What are you going to leave behind? How are you improving the world? And this is a realization that everyone has to come to individually. Mm. And in the context of all the stuff we've discussed this morning on the show, and really we've been all over the world and down some pretty deep rabbit holes, and there are plenty more where these came from. I think that we're starting to scratch at something that is the real itch, as opposed to the surface nonsense that we're constantly distracted by. Do you think so?
Go, Kenton. You go, and then I'll
start another argument.
No, I agree with that viewpoint completely. You know, I've always said that, you know, religious people, in spite of the fact that I believe that the reason why they do it is flawed, and the reason is that they're afraid of retribution from a divine power, but that actually is what makes them safe, productive members of society, because of the fact that they're forced to develop a conscience. Now, I have a conscience because it's enlightened self-interest. But the fact that the majority of people in the world develop a sense of conscience because of the fact that religion exists, I think is an important thing in terms of the fabric of society. And that's the reason why it's actually important to ensure that it doesn't collapse, because that creates that vacuum that allows the leftists to do the kind of
damage,
stuff, the damage that they're doing around the world. I think, Jonathan, you'd agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, I mostly agree with that. I think, you know, whether you and this is what you get on our podcast, by the way, while I'm here, I can just plug it. You must
listen to the Overton Pod. This is the longest ad for the Overton Pod I've ever heard.
But essentially, you know, if you're a believer, then religion is a playbook. If you're not a believer, you've got to find your own playbook. As I mentioned, most people are not don't have the mental capacity to do that. It's not an insult. It's just, you know, religion is wisdom over thousands of years. Mm. Judaism comes out 4,500 years ago. Christianity follows on from that, takes a lot of teachings from it, adds its own on top of it. Islam comes, after that and takes a lot from that and adds its own on top of that. Hinduism comes before all of that. Over the ages adds on and takes wisdom from the living of thousands, millions of people that have come before us. And so that's a playbook. That's a playbook for how to exist on the planet in a way that is productive. And so if you want to use religion to find your place on earth, and I don't think most people have religion because of retribution, because they are trying to make sure they don't burn in eternal hell. I think most people have religion because some people do have it for that reason or do believe for that reason, but I think most people have it because it provides them with some meaning. And I think that if you don't want religion, if you look at the United States, you look at the MAGA movement, what is that? That's nationalism. Right. And nationalism in a country like America, which has lost itself in the last 30 to 40 years, nationalism is a way to say, this is what we are as Americans. This is what we stand for. This is what we believe in. Same as religion. Right. And so it gives some people a direction in life, and it gives them a way to move. And so they know that their life will be stable and have meaning, and their kids' lives will be stable and have meaning. And so that's really what all of this does. And the problem with leftism is, and what, you know, what leftists will tell you, progressivism, we have to progress. It's constantly we have to progress, and it's a train without a station. And the problem with a train without a station is eventually you run out of track, and then you crash very, very badly and catastrophically. And that's what we're really seeing in the West. We're seeing that progress train go off the rails, crash, and explode into a ravine.
Well, there we go. Are we in a good place in South Africa? Time will tell. What the hell was that?
Was my AirPods.
Okay. Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, Canthan.
I just want to get in a last word.
Go on, Gareth. Always.
Can we send a shout out to Sibusiso in Tamil?
Sure.
Okay. Are you familiar with Sibusiso in Tamil?
No.
So Sibusiso in Tamil is a person who was caught out with having a fake ID.
Oh.
He was actually a Bangladeshi named Saddam Hussein who shaved his head and passed for black.
Great.
And he's been doing it for the longest time, and he got caught fairly recently. So the news
is faking black.
Yeah. Faking black. You're caught for not being black. Sure.
It's incredible, but you take a look at his picture and you can see how it could actually be pulled off.
I'm very pleased you brought him up. I will go and spend the rest of the day trying to find out more about this person. And good luck to Leon Schreiber at Home Affairs to try and sort that one out. All right, we are done for the day. I think that's plenty of stuff to chew on. And thank you very, very much for joining us this morning. Lots of great comments. I'm sorry I didn't get to all of them. We will be back with another Burning Platform same time next week. Cheers.